Welcome to the People Who Read People podcast. Today I'll be talking to Dr. Brian Baer, a skilled Russian to English translator, about clues in English text that indicate a writer or speaker is a native Russian speaker. We'll also be talking about language and translation in general. First, I wanted to give this subject a little framing. I think most people are aware that there have been attempts by Russia to manipulate events in the United States. I'm sure you've heard of Russia creating American impersonating social media accounts and making divisive Facebook ads and similar things. And I still often see Twitter accounts that I think are suspicious, accounts that claim to be American citizens, but whose language strikes me as awkward and stilted in unusual ways. It's not that it's just bad or ignorant English. It's a weird combination of strangely good or sophisticated English, but phrased very strangely in ways that you seldom hear Americans talk. So I thought it would be interesting to dig into this question a bit and see if there were known indicators or tells specifically about native Russian writers writing in English. And also just to talk about general indicators of crossing language boundaries. But I also want to say that I'm not an alarmist about Russian manipulation specifically. There's no shortage of sources of disinformation and propaganda and fake news apart from Russia. For example, in the United States, we have a very influential fake news creator named Mike Moore, who goes by the name of True Pundit, who was arguably a major influence in getting Trump elected. And then there are various other skewed and biased news created in this country, from scary, hate-filled religious AM radio, to the well-known lies of Breitbart, on to the more mainstream Fox News and their mindless Trump cheerleading. And also, when it comes to foreign fake news and fake accounts, there are plenty of financially motivated creators of fake news, not motivated by propaganda reasons. A lot has been written about Macedonia and their large fake news industry. The way this works is that people make clickbait fake news websites, and then other people are motivated to use fake or deceptive social media accounts to go out and rile up people, get them angry, get them to click on those headlines. And then those fake news sites make money on ad traffic. In short, these people have monetized fear and anger, and by meeting that demand, they create demand for more fear and anger. There are financially motivated fake news creators across the world. Some, for example, are in the Philippines, some are even in Russia. And that means that even if someone is located in Russia and creating fake news, it doesn't mean they're necessarily on Putin's payroll. They could just be doing it for the money, like other people are across the world. And we also have financially motivated fake news creators in this country. There's a fake news site called TatersGonnaTate.com that defends itself as being a parody comedy site, but they make their money in the same way. They rile up conservative hate and anger and clicks. Same with the Christian site The Babylon Bee, which also hides behind being a comedy site, but is run by pro-Trump people, and these people know that many gullible conservatives believe their over-the-top liberal-bashing headlines. I've seen many people in pro-Trump Facebook groups getting riled up by these kinds of headlines. The end result is the same as any Russian disinformation campaign. And there are assorted other domestic fake news creators. You can Google an American citizen named Justin Kohler, who ran fake news sites that spread pro-Trump propaganda leading up to the 2016 election. All this is to say that there are plenty of sources of bullshit and lies these days. We're pretty much swimming in it, even without Russia. And finally, I want to say that, of course, there's nothing wrong with someone being a native Russian speaker and posting stuff online. For example, there are United States citizens who may be Russian native speakers. When it comes to online behavior, especially on platforms like Twitter, where anonymity is a purposeful feature, there are many things we just can't know and won't be able to know. So there's often limited value, even when you're confident someone is a Russian first language speaker. Now, having said all that, I think most people aren't aware of how in-depth some of these fake accounts and propaganda attempts were that Putin implemented. I think most people are aware of the more simplistic Russian origin social media accounts, the ones that have kind of bot-like behavior and do various simple tweets and retweets. But there were quite a few accounts that worked very hard at fooling people, harder than I think most people realize. In 2017, there were some popular right-wing online personalities who were outed as fake Russian creations. These accounts had many fake pictures, portrayed themselves as young women, wrote Medium articles, responded to messages, and were even quoted in prominent mainstream news outlets. I'll read a little bit about this from this 2017 Philadelphia Inquirer story by Rob Tourneau. Jenna Abrams was a popular figure in right-wing social media circles. Boasting nearly 70,000 followers, Abrams was featured in numerous news articles during the 2016 election, spotlighted by outlets as varied as USA Today, The Washington Post, the BBC, and Yahoo Sports. Her tweet about CNN airing porn during Anthony Bourdain's show, It Didn't, was reported by numerous outlets. But Abrams never existed. According to information released by House Democrats earlier this week, Abrams was one of more than 2,700 fake Twitter accounts created by employees at the Internet Research Agency, a troll farm funded by the Russian government based in St. Petersburg. In addition to the Abrams account, several other popular conservative social media personalities, Laura Bailey, South Lone Star, 10_GOP, were all revealed to be troll accounts. All of them have been deactivated on Twitter. End quote. I want to read another few paragraphs from that article. Pamela Moore, another popular online personality during the 2016 election who tweeted using the handle @Pamela_Moore13, was also created in the same Russian troll factory with the same basic mission, to sow division and heighten racial tension among Americans. Unlike the Abrams account, which went out of its way to say it wasn't pro-Trump, nearly all of Moore's tweets leading up to the election appear to have been crafted to support Trump's campaign. Among the account's most widely shared posts leading up to the election were tweets repeating lies and conspiracy theories about Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and pushing themes of Trump's campaign, including this anti-refugee post that was shared more than 4,700 times. Former Trump National Security Advisor Michael Flynn followed both accounts. His son, Michael Flynn Jr., shared a tweet from the Abrams account just days before the election. Flynn wasn't alone. Donald Trump Jr., Kellyanne Conway, and Brad Parscale, Trump's campaign digital director, all retweeted fake Russian Twitter accounts in the month before the election. Vice President Mike Pence followed five different accounts tied to the Internet Research Agency, according to the Daily Beast. End quote. So again, while we may debate how much Russia actually is to blame for the lies and the mess we find ourselves in, it's clear that Russia has and probably will continue to try to influence us in deceptive ways. And that's the reason I thought there might be some value to learning about some tells of native Russian speakers or writers. But also worth remembering, Russia has likely learned from their mistakes and is even better at what they do. So maybe we'd only be learning to spot the tells of the most obvious and non-professional deceivers. Also, some Trump supporters enjoy pretending to be bots and foreign accounts just to bother and troll people. So we have to keep that in mind too. Things are often not what they seem online, and it pays to not jump to conclusions. Aside from learning practically useful tips, I figured this conversation would just be intellectually interesting from a language and translation point of view. Also, if you stick around after the interview, there's some more content about analyzing Russian origin speech. Okay, that's it for the long intro. Here's the interview. Hello, and welcome to the People Who Read People podcast. I'm Zachary Elwood. Today is May 27th, 2020. Today, we'll be talking about indicators that an English text was created by a native Russian speaker and other translation topics. My guest today is Dr. Brian Baer. Dr. Baer is a professor of Russian and Translation Studies at Kent State University, where he's a member of the Institute for Applied Linguistics. His recent translation work includes a Penguin collection of Russian short stories and the soon-to-be-released novel Red Crosses by Sasha Filipenko. Welcome, Dr. Baer.
Thanks, Zach.
Thanks so much for coming on. When's the Red Crosses book coming out?
Well, we sent in the proofs, the corrected proofs last week, so I'm hoping a couple months it'll be out.
Nice. Mm-hmm. And you've had several other books too besides the...
Yeah, I kind of alternate between literary things like this and more scholarly translations. So.
Yeah, and if anyone's interested, you can find Dr. Baer's work on Amazon. Just look for Brian Baer and probably Russian too, mm-hmm. and you'll find them. So, and you had mentioned also, besides your translation and teaching work, you had done some legal testimony with regards to language. Could you describe a little bit of that?
Well, yeah, it was interesting. It was a case where a key factor was showing that a document that had supposedly been authored by one person who was a native speaker of English had in fact been authored by a Russian native speaker. So they brought me in to see if there was evidence in this text that which would suggest that the author was indeed specifically Russian.
Hmm. And are you able to say what you found or what the what the significance was?
Sure. A lot of it, I mean, in the end, I know he won the case based on the testimony. So, but yes, typical things, you know, the use of articles. There are certain giveaways. And in fact, everyone with a dominant first language, when they speak another language, they'll have specific, you know, giveaways that they're as to what their first language is. And for Russian, there are very specific ones. Some of them are common to other languages, but, you know, the use of articles. Russian doesn't have any articles at all. So we have definite articles like the and indefinite articles, a and an. Russians don't have them. So when Russians speak English, again, depending on when they acquired English, this will be a problem for them. And in fact, when you if you pause for a minute and think about it, explaining to someone when you would choose the and when you would choose a, I mean, sometimes it's obvious, other times it's very nuanced. And a lot of it is in, you know, repetition, listening, doing it. But yeah, it can be very, very nuanced. But that's often a giveaway. So, you know, I go to store, right? The absence of the store, this would be typical.
Is that a, would you say that's a common across, you know, many languages, or would you say that's more specific to Russian?
Well, languages that don't have articles, and there's a good number that don't. Chinese doesn't. Most Slavic languages don't. So,
because
yeah.
It sounded like kind of a general one you would hear often from many recent immigrants or something.
Right. Yeah. A lot of languages that don't have articles, or their article use, you know, even French with articles similar to English, there are differences in the way they use them. But those languages that don't have articles at all, it's a real problem.
I guess we can go through some of the main areas, and you had sent me four. And so the incorrect use of articles was one of them. And then the next one was improper use of verb tenses.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So English, like the Romance languages too, French, Spanish, anyone who's taken, you know, you think Spanish in first year is kind of easy. Then you get to third year where you're doing all these verb forms and the subjunctive and everything. It's very complicated. And English has a very complex verbal system. And so, for example, the only present tense form of the Russian verb to live, я живу, can be translated as I live, I am living, I have been living, I do live, right? So all of those functions are within that one form. There's no other present tense form of that verb to live. Again, I don't like people to think that, oh, some languages are simpler than others, because Russian does the work that we do with an elaborate tense system. They do it a little differently. So every verb or every activity that's described by verb has two verbs, one that we call the imperfective and one that we call perfective. So the imperfective will be used to express things like, well, how an action is done. Is it repeated? Are we stressing the duration of the action, as opposed to the perfective verb that would be used to suggest that the action is completed, is a one-time action, or if it has to end before another action begins. So sequencing of actions as opposed to simultaneous activities, where we would use the imperfective. So there are two verb forms. So I don't want anyone to get the impression that Russian doesn't have all these forms. They do things differently with their verb forms. But in terms of tense, the system of tense all by itself is much simpler in Russian. And so that's why the example I gave you before with the articles, I go to store, you'll find that most Russians will default, again, depending on how what their proficiency in English is, but a new learner of English would say, I go to store. So they default on the simple present form when we would probably say, I'm going to the store, right? Where are you going? I'm going to the store.
Mm. Is it accurate to say that it's not that the Russian or other languages are simpler, it's that when they're trying to use the specific form of English, like, which is tense focused in that case, they're losing the other tools that they have at their disposal, basically.
Right, exactly. So basically the languages do things in different ways. And I just make that caveat because, you know, when Western explorers of China in the 18th and 19th century, you know, they said, oh, Chinese doesn't have any grammar. And obviously that's a weird way to put it, but the language does things in different ways. And sometimes what they're referring to is what we call high context languages, where a lot of it is the meaning is indicated by the context itself, whereas English is a very low context language. And so we spell everything out. Everything's indicated there and much less context specific. But yeah, for the verbs in Russian. So for an English speaker learning Russian, deciding when to use the perfective form of the verb and the imperfective, that's really tough. And again, there are certain easy situations, but then there's a bunch of gray area in between that's really hard to master.
So is Russian like some other languages where the, for spoken language anyway, is there a lot of meaning in the tones or things like that more so than in English, or is it roughly similar when it comes to that kind of thing?
Well, I would say its intonations are different, quite different. And they have, we teach 6 different intonation patterns. Again, they're quite different from English ones. So I've seen students in Russia trying to speak Russian, and sometimes they'll be asking a question, but they're not using the right intonation pattern. So Russians just look at them like they're making a statement, and they don't know, they don't know that they're supposed to answer. So the intonation patterns are quite specific, and they're different from ours.
Would you say it's equivalent, though? Like, because I guess you could say English has a similar thing where intonation is important for questions and things like that. Would you say it's more equivalent to English, but just different? Or is it a vastly different scale of intonation being meaningful, if that makes sense?
Well, probably intonation is similarly meaningful, but the patterns are quite just different.
Right, yeah. Gotcha.
And also you get in English, especially with, teenage English and things, you get a lot of question patterning used for statements, right? Where people go up at the end, which would be typical for a question, and young people sometimes just use that as a statement too. So you don't get quite as much of that in Russian, that the intonation patterns are quite defined.
So getting to the third thing you mentioned for clues was improper coordination of tenses in complex sentences.
Yeah, so that's very different in Russian from in English. English, it's very similar to the French coordination of tenses. And this means when you have a complex sentence, which is composed of at least 2 clauses, and a clause means you have a subject plus a predicate, so at least 2 different subjects and 2 different predicates, what is the relationship between the verb form or tense in the main clause and in the subordinate clause? So the easiest way to show what I mean is if we have an if-then clause. So, for example, if it rains tomorrow, we'll go to the movies. So in English, present tense in the if clause, if it rains, then future, we'll go to the movies. Russian does the same tense in both. So if it will rain tomorrow, we will go to the movies. So, если пойдет дождь завтра, то мы пойдем в кино. Then in the past tense, in English, we use past in the main clause and conditional in the subordinate clause. So, if it had rained yesterday, we would have gone to the movies. And again, Russian will use past conditional and conditional. Если бы пошел дождь вчера, то мы бы пошли в кино. So again, that's a different coordination. This is super hard for people to master. It just sounds so unusual to them to use the different coordination of tenses.
So basically, whenever there's two clauses showing up with two different verbs, they're often getting those kind of situations wrong, basically.
Right. So the tenses they'll get wrong. If a Russian speaker, for example, would use two future tenses, whereas we need present plus future or past plus conditional. Yeah. And this is the same, similar in Russian when they're giving reported speech. So if I said in English, let's say someone in quotation marks says, "I want to go to the movies." Then we take away the quotation marks and we report that. He said he wanted to go to the movies, right? So that "I want to go to the movies," that is what he actually said, has to go into the past in English when we report it in the past. In Russian, they would keep that in the exact same tense that the person had uttered it. So, он сказал, что хочет пойти в кино. So the present tense. It would be the exact same tense as it was initially reported.
And that would be he, instead of saying he said that he was tired, it would be he said that he is tired.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And then finally, you said one of the last ones was word order.
Yeah. So Russian has fairly free word order. Because it's what we call an inflected language, it's like Latin. So every word will change its ending based on its role in the sentence, right? So the actual, what we call the morphology of the word, its actual form will change if it's a direct object or if it's in an indirect object or something else. So, for example, very simple example, Boris loves Natasha. In Russian, it would be Boris любит Наташу. So Natasha becomes Наташу because she's the object of Boris's affection. What this means then is that word order doesn't play such an important role as it does in English in letting us know who loves whom, right? In English, if I change that word order and I say, Boris loves Natasha, and I change it and say Natasha loves Boris, that means something different. But Russian, as long as I keep the ending of Natasha as Natashu, I could put Natashu anywhere in that sentence.
Oh, she is loved. Yeah.
Boris Natashu любит, or Natashu Boris любит. So the word order doesn't mean as much. So this becomes a challenge. I always tell my beginning students, you can't read Russian like you read English. You read English, you start, you kind of expect to find a subject somewhere near the beginning, then your predicate, and then a bunch of objects. That would be the neutral thing. Russian, it is very often not the case. It's quite often, especially at the beginning of a paragraph or something, or to find the subject at the very end of your sentence. So I always tell them, find the verb, and then determine from the form of the verb what your subject is. Is it going to be singular? If it's past tense, is it going to be masculine or feminine? And then go find your subject. So if it's a simple sentence, it's not so hard. But when it's these very long, complex Russian sentences, you can't read it like English, because they'll often take, what is it, the first noun, which might be the direct object in Russian, and they'll take it as the subject.
And you had given an example there where you said one example of a word order being out of place was it is a popular in Russia book. So sort of like using that an adjective in front of the or that kind of awkward adjective clause in front of the book like that.
Right. And that's one I'm really surprised with my translation students, Russians, even those who have really excellent English. This one will stay sometimes. Again, it doesn't sound, it's so ingrained in them that they'll sometimes use it in English, whereas in English it sounds very strange. So yes, you can have an adjective plus a noun, but then you can put modifiers of the adjective in between the adjective and the noun. So yes, you get something like, oh, it's a popular in Russia book, which we can't say in English. And so I always say, you know, you have to take those modifiers, take them out, put them at the end. Usually it's a book that's popular in Russia.
And then you had another one, collocations, words that typically occur together.
Yeah. So a very easy example is, for example, in English, we say to brush your teeth. Russians, they use the verb chistit, to wash, right? So if you're doing a very literal translation or someone who doesn't know, you get to wash your teeth, which sounds absurd in English, right? So, but it, they're not different in the different cultures. They mean the same thing. But the words, we call them collocations. They're words that occur commonly together. And so in English, brush occurs with teeth, not wash. Yeah, that's a typical one. But in this book I just translated, there are two protagonists. One's a young guy. He's a soccer referee. And the other's an older woman. She has Alzheimer's. She's probably in her late 70s. And she's quite educated. She spoke many languages and things. So when he describes her at one point after he just meets her, because she badgers him with questions, he uses a word. Now, I'm not going to remember the Russian word, but I initially translated it as annoying. And I had a bilingual editor, which is wonderful. And she's actually a wonderful bilingual editor. And this is a real treat, because mostly editors now are monolingual, so they can't look at the source text, the original, and compare it with your translation. They're just editing your English translation. So anyway, my bilingual editor changed annoying to obnoxious. And I thought, okay, the semantics of the Russian word could support that. But I don't think this guy would say that about an old woman. You know, I would say obnoxious about a young kid or a teenage, you know, a wise guy or a drunk or something.
It's more aggressive a descriptor, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so anyway, it's things like that where you start to think not only what words are used together, but what would a certain person say, and then what would that person say to another person?
Very subtle.
Yeah, it becomes very subtle. So that's why when they say when you translate, you really dig deep into language. And that's why when people often describe translators as actors, right? Because you're dealing with the words of another person and interpreting them. It's not quite exact, because an actor usually is acting out one character. And when you're translating, especially a novel with a bunch of different characters, you have to play all of them. And then you also have to direct their interaction with each other, right? What words would they say to each other? So you're kind of like a director in that sense too. So it becomes very complicated. Very complicated.
Right, you're running a simulation of reality in your mind. Yeah.
Right, right.
So I was curious, I might be off base on this, but when you talked about the different, the different clues, different categories of clues, it seems like the first few about tenses and articles and word order seem like more general ones that might apply to, quite a few languages. But then when you talk about the co-locations, that seems like those could be very, very specific, like, oh, that's a Russian turn of phrase, or that's another language turn of phrase. And they're using, things that reflect how they use it in their own language. Would that be accurate to say?
Yeah, definitely. And even there's little things like sometimes in legal documents, our word evidence is what we call a mass noun. It doesn't have a singular version. You can't say, that's an interesting evidence, or he brought in many evidences, right? We can't say that. It's a mass noun. So it's the evidence in general was convincing. And if you want to count the evidence, you have to use something like pieces of evidence, right? They submitted several pieces of evidence. Russian has a word, pokazanie, which has a singular form and a plural form. So when I was working with students and they were translating legal documents, the Russian students would often do that, like evidences, things like that.
Sounds like there can be more general clues that just give you the sense that someone isn't English first language. And then there's like, sometimes you stumble across like, oh, this is really specific.
Right. I mean, for me, I understood that, they're translating the Russian pokazanie, and they don't understand that our English word evidence is a mass noun and doesn't have a singular version.
I was curious when you did the testimony, were there certain things that really made the case? And if so, What kinds of clues were those, or what kinds of evidence were those?
Yeah, well, it's certainly the repeated misuse of articles. It was consistent throughout. Also, that weird placement of modifiers, like between an adjective and a noun, that's a definite tell. Mm-hmm. Then there was a really interesting spelling mistake. So there was a person that was referred to in the document who had a name of five letters and two O's in it. And so in Russian pronunciation, it has very strong stress. And vowels that are not under stress are reduced. So, for example, an O when under stress is a very full O sound, but when it's not under stress, it can be an or even a schwa, an eh. So, for example, in the Russian word for milk, which has three O's, M-O-L-O-K-O, it's molako. So none of those O's is pronounced the same. So this person was consistently spelling this name, which had two O's in it, spelling one of the O's as an ah. And that was clearly what a Russian would do because they could not pronounce two O's as O's. One of them would have to be reduced to an ah sound or a schwa sound. So that I thought was a giveaway too.
Is that a different class than we talked about? Would that be like phonetic mistakes?
Yes,
or something?
You're right. That's phonetics, right?
Huh.
Yeah,
that's interesting, huh?
Yeah.
So yeah, you're drawing from every tool at your disposal to I guess right. That comes second nature when you're that. When you're that comfortable with it.
Well, I guess, and phonetics, but then as it's reflected in spelling, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that's why when people emigrate, a lot will depend on their age as to whether they will preserve their first language and how they will preserve it, whether it continues to develop or not. And a big factor is, can they read and write by the time they get here? And if not, if they come when they're very young and they never learn to read and write in Russian, that's super hard to work with. So I'd work with, they're often referred to as heritage speakers, so people who grew up in the United States but maybe spoke another language in their home but didn't go to school in that language. So and heritage speakers, they can have all different levels of proficiency, right? So someone who comes very young who never went to school, never learned to read and write, will have a very different level of proficiency from someone who came much later and had attended school in the other country. And so for those people who came very young, their spelling is really hard to ever correct because they spell phonetically. And it's hard to get them out of that habit.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, I've often heard the idea that language can affect, your way of thinking, viewing the world just because of the way it's structured. Do you feel that's the case in Russian, with the, for example, like you said, the nouns having the action being done to them built in and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like it leads to a different way of thinking, viewing the world? Do you find that you've viewed the world differently learning Russian? Is there anything to that?
that's a very controversial question. Potentially, I think. I mean, it is interesting, and people have written about this, that the fact that, Russian has very common in Russian to have what we call subjectless constructions, in which there's no grammatical subject. So, people will tie this to this idea that a more communal culture, a culture that's less focused on the I and individualism and things like that. But it is true that you can have very common to have subjectless constructions, like to me something something, like Minya holodna, I'm cold, would be to me it is cold. And almost all states in Russian would be like that. To me it is this, as opposed to I am this.
Mm. Yeah, I can see how that would be a controversial topic. It sounds a little, it seems like you could easily build a case for all sorts of things. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, it is interesting. It's probably what makes Russian poetry so incredible. They have a lot of options, especially with the word order, as I said, so they can do a lot of things. And that's why Russian poetry tends to still be metered and rhymed, because the potential for that is so great in the language, with the endings and then with the free word order that you can put things almost anywhere.
I'm also curious, something I've always wondered is how long you have to be to work on mastering a language before you start to think in it. And does it happen all of a sudden, or did it just, did you find yourself kind of gradually doing that?
Right. I mean, often when you're in an immersion environment, it will start to happen. So I studied for many years in an all-Russian school in Vermont. It was Norwich. It was a military academy, but in the summer they had a Russian school, and it was 8 weeks, and we spoke only Russian, and all the instructors were Russian, and we had a choir, and we put on a play and things like that. So I remember there being one of the first times where I remember dreaming in Russian. And usually conversations and things happening in Russian. But yeah, usually when you're in an immersion environment like that, it'll start to
click. Was it a magical or surprising experience when, for example, you found yourself dreaming or thinking, you know, kind of fluently in Russian, or did it come on gradually, or was there a sudden, you know, aha moment or something?
I think I mean, I don't know about my waking moment, but when I did dream it the first time, I thought, oh, that was cool that I woke up and I was like, wow, that just happened in my head.
That stood out. Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. Have you done any other work related to, you know, online text analysis besides that case you mentioned? Is that something you frequently do, or is that fairly rare?
Well, a lot of my familiarity with the kind of these tells comes a lot from correcting translations into English done by Russian-speaking students. So I'll see what are the common patterns that they find difficult to break. And I say some of them persist even with students who have a very high proficiency in English, and it just those deep, deep structures in the language. And then sometimes I've observed, you know, the opposite phenomenon where people have come over as immigrants. They have pretty good Russian, quite fluent, in fact. Maybe they came over when they were 10 or 11, 12, so they'd been to school in the other language. But it's not long after being, you know, a few years in an American high school, maybe a couple years in college, and then they start, their Russian starts exhibiting features of English, which is very interesting. And one of them that it happened and it surprised me because the students, their Russian was quite good, and it was the use of if. So in English, we would say something like, I don't know if he's going to come. And in Russian, we can't say that. It's more like, I don't know whether he'll come. So if in Russian is yesli, but in a construction like that, I don't know whether or not he's coming, we would use this particle li, which comes at the end of yesli, but just the li, and it's what we call an enclitic. It comes in the second position. So you would say, for example, I don't know, comes ли он? Я не знаю, придет ли он? Whether he will come. And they were using если, if in there, which is completely wrong in Russian. And it was the clear influence of English. And that was one of the only places I heard that influence. And I heard it in two or three students of that age. And that blew my mind, why it was that specific form that penetrated their Russian and influenced it in that way.
So is there a word for that when, you know, like Spanglish for Spanish and, you know, English combination? Is there a word for Russia and English combination?
Oh, right. I don't know if we have that. Yeah, I'm familiar with Spanglish. I haven't heard Russish. Yeah.
You can invent that.
Yeah, right.
invent the word for it anyway. Okay. Anything else stand out? This has been a great conversation. Anything else stand out as something interesting in, you know, the tells indicators area?
Well, I mean, I guess the only other thing is language is such an incredibly interesting thing. It's so living, and you see, you know, it fades away if you don't use it, and if you're not in an environment that cultivates it. And so, again, the time you come over as an immigrant is going to determine a lot of how much of your first language you preserve. So kids who come over, again, if they've already been to school in Russia a little bit and they can read and write, and if their family encourages them to continue to read and write, they will probably preserve their Russian. But, you know, there is a teeny itsy bitsy minority of any population that is what we call a balanced bilingual, which means they have basically the same level of proficiency in two languages. This is extremely rare. And you have to be, you know, someone who comes over maybe at age 11, 12, they've been to school in Russia, they've got good Russian reading, writing, and then they come and maybe they've already had some English and then they start studying English and they keep up their Russian, etc., then maybe. But it's such a tiny group of people, because if you don't go to school and you're not cultivating that other language through schooling so that you can talk about abstract things, it will soon be dominated by that other language. And that's why a lot of immigrant children end up with what we call kitchen Russian. So yeah, they can speak it at home with their parents and their grandparents, but they're never exposed to science and math and geography in that language. So their Russian doesn't become more sophisticated in that respect.
Gotcha. Okay. So this has been very interesting, and thanks a lot for coming on. And finally, I just want to mention again that you've got the Penguin Publishing House collection of Russian short stories coming out, and the also the Red Cross's novel translation by Sasha Filipenko. As far as how people might contact you, what would you prefer?
Oh, they're welcome to contact me by email at brianjamesbear@gmail.com.
And that's Bear, last name is B-A-E-R, so it's that's Brian, right? James Bear. Okay, great. Thanks a lot, Dr. Bear. This has been very interesting.
Thanks, Zach. It was great talking to you.
I'd like to end with an analysis of a potential Russian origin comment that was left on a UK newspaper site. The following excerpt was written by William Campbell, who has a podcast called Challenging Opinions. And it's a good listen, by the way. Campbell's post starts out talking about the wrong use of articles, which was something Dr. Bear talked about. I'll now read from midway through Campbell's piece. This is where the comment by DM Reader in lovely England on a Daily Mail online article about Nigel Farage and Ukraine from a while back comes in. I'll read it verbatim. Farage is against the USA-EU expansionist mission, wants us to stay away from business that's not concern of ours. So I'm not surprised that one pro-Russian activist with a common sense contacted a politician who sees the situation in Ukraine in a logical order. There's a number of things here. Let's leave aside the content, why someone in lovely England would be so concerned that Nigel Farage take a stance on the conflict in Ukraine. Let's just look at the language. Quote, stay away from business that's not concern of ours, end quote. That's weird phrasing. You could say not a concern of ours, you could say no concern of ours, but not concern of ours isn't something typical of an English speaker. Then there's the mention of one pro-Russian activist with a common sense. With a common sense, who says that? Not native speakers. And, quote, sees the situation in a logical order. That's a strange way to put it, but it seems to me to be a direct translation of Russian phraseology. Not to mention that we are expected to believe that DM Reader in lovely England seems well up, not just on the conflict in Ukraine, but also Farage's position on it. Looking at the language, and I have significant expertise in this area, I haven't a shadow of doubt that this text was written by a Russian speaker. But here's the thing, this text wasn't written recently. It wasn't even written at the time of the UK Brexit referendum. It was written in April 2014, years before either that referendum or that presidential election. The Daily Mail Online is the biggest UK online news source and an obvious target for campaigns of influence. They might have started sloppy with writers who have middling English doing heavy-handed messaging, but it would be foolish to think that they've given up on it or not gotten better at it. Make no mistake, this is information warfare. And that's the end of William Campbell's quote. And again, that's William Campbell has a podcast called Challenging Opinions. And I was actually on his podcast a year or so ago to talk about fake news and fake accounts. Maybe it was a couple years ago now. This has been the People Who Read People podcast with me, Zachary Elwood. If you like this interview, please give the podcast a like or a review on the platform you listen on. And if you'd like to learn more about my work on behavior, check out readingpokertells.com. I'm the author of some books on poker behavior, also known as Poker Tells. Thanks for listening.